Senate Committee on Judiciary, Wednesday, February 19th, 1975, Room 407A. Lisa? That's the room at 161.
I have no written statement to present Senator Brown. I just got called the other evening and was asked to represent the National Association of Social Workers in this matter. My name is Ajax Moody. Association I'm representing is the National Association of Social Workers. The abbreviation is NASW. I come to present the view that was voted on in a committee to consider legislation concerning children, and the unanimous vote of our Association Committee on Legislation for Children was in favor of the passage of Senate Bill 161. I believe I was asked to present testimony because of my employment as a juvenile court director, where I have experience dealing with the consequences of this state not participating in the Interstate Compact on Children for Placement of Dependents. I should like this committee to take note that it results in children being dumped in this state by other states without support or the acceptance of responsibility by the sending state. Frequently, these placements are not examined before the child is placed there. They're frequently inappropriate for the interests of the child, and as a consequence, there is a frequent failure of the child in that placement. When the child fails in the placement, this can be either because the receiving family is not prepared emotionally or financially to receive the child and to meet his needs, or it's because the child misbehaves in a law-violated fashion or other way. The consequences to this, as I view it, as a court director, is that we frequently, in these cases, wind up having to take action, having to find jurisdiction, and having to place the child in the care and custody of Children Services Division, where it becomes a burden financially to the state of Oregon.
For example, the
There are, I would say, two major ways. One is the child is known to a child caring agency in the sending state. A worker there discusses the child's resources with the child's family or with the child, and they hear of a great aunt Matilda, or Uncle Joe, or a friend of the family who lives in that wonderful state of Oregon. And they encourage the child and the family to send the child there. This is done without any consideration as to making provision for the child's legal care. These children are in this state without a guardian or other legally responsible person to provide for the child's care, such as medical or the signing of documents for driver's licenses or what have you. You as a lawyer would be familiar with that.
Don't we do the same thing with them?
I think we do to some extent. I don't think that justifies it, however. And I believe the adoption of this bill would put the clamps on our doing it also.
I'd like to apologize for being late. I thought it was in 201 in public service building. I raced all the way over there because I thought it was over here, and I looked in the calendar, and I thought, oh no, it's in a public service building, and I was thinking very smugly that it was close by, so I went somewhere over there, and up there, and no, it's not a good thing to me. I was tracking down.
It happens to members of the community.
I have to confess, I was over on the wrong side of the Senate chamber, up on the fourth floor myself.
That's a good idea. And, Senator Carson, there's a Senator's and daughter's gonna be over.
Then you can find it.
Right, are you ready to make this one?
Ajax, I don't know, Ajax, do you need your voice to send it out?
Just stay where you are. Where do you start on that?
I'm for it, I don't think you'll mind that.
No. Well, Senate Bill 161, adopting the compact on placement of children. Prohibits placement, until the receiving state is notified, sending agency that placement is not contrary to interest of the child. It provides penalties for illegal placement, and gives the sending agency jurisdiction of the child, making the sending agency responsible for support and maintenance of the child, and enacts incidental legislation. As you might know, the interstate compact on placement of children has existed since 1951. 24 states have now adopted the compact, and currently between 12 and 15 additional states are considering compact legislation. The purpose of the interstate compact is to provide the protection of state law to children placed across state lines and to foster care, adoption, or institutions for children. The great majority of interstate placements are in the areas of foster care and adoption. When such placements are made and fail without adequate preparations and safeguards, the consequences can be sudden and severe, both to the children and governmental agencies, which must then find ways to look after them. The interstate compact requires that no sending agency or person, defining the compact as an agency, will place a child into another compact state until it has notified the appropriate public authorities in the receiving state and received a report as to the existing conditions which does not reveal anything substantially inimitable to the feasibility of the placement. Until the child reaches the age of majority, becomes self-supporting, or is adopted, the sending agency or person retains financial responsibility for the child and retains whatever degree of jurisdiction would have had in their own state in matters necessary for child custody care and supervision. The compact will not interfere with interstate placements made by the child's parents, guardians, or close relatives, such as brother, sister, aunt, or uncle. Further, the compact will not supersede a conflict with existing Oregon laws or legally based child care plans. The interstate compact on children does not require budget appropriation. Annual compact dues are $100. Overall, enactment of the interstate compact will undoubtedly result in measurable savings to the state of Oregon, and the defendant state will now assume greater responsibility for placing the children of Oregon than now is the case. There are perhaps 300 to 400 children being flowed back to court each year, and there will be a trade-off. The Interstate Compact has the solid support of organizations such as the Child Welfare League of America, the American Public Welfare Association, the Conference of Western Attorney General, and the National Catholic Charities Organization. It's difficult to gain an accurate fix on the number of placements made in the state of Oregon from other states. That says it appears to be about 300 to 400 children per year, back and forth flow of placements from both foster care and adoption. The passage of Senate Bill 161 will guarantee that fewer of these placements will fail, thereby leaving fewer out-of-state children in Oregon without support or supervision, and in many cases placing additional financial burden on the state. Compacts of this nature are not foolproof, but they are definitely beneficial to the participating state governments whose the client serves. And I might add that as a juvenile court counselor and Children's Services caseworker, I saw a number of placements where arrangements were made to send a child out of state, and there was no way of guaranteeing that the receiving state would provide supervision. It was a matter of courtesy. It was not a matter of an agreement, a compact. And so in many cases, we could send a child for a foster care placement out of state, and we'd find only two ways: that the home was not suitable, and that been unable to check it out long range. Another thing that we found out too was that many times we place a child in a family to foster care, the one member of the family gets a job offer, for example, from out of state. What do you do if the family has really worked well with the child is happy, they've been together for maybe quite some time, and the family has to move across the state line? Well, if you don't have some way to continue supervision, you cannot allow that the child to move with the family. And that is a real tragedy. That's another reason for this bill.
Does this bind us to the same obligation at the end of the contact then? If we send somebody, we're responsible for their care, and
that's
and
right.
We also do
only with contact states. In other words, it's only with
yeah.
states that have a reciprocal agreement.
I would also just want to mention, I would assume that probably children go to more often than they have to talk to me about the contact states.
At the present time, I don't believe that they are, because they are considering it. I have some people here today who would perhaps be better suited to answer questions about how it's working in other states, and which states have gone to what extent in the ratified contact.
Is there any way you can think of that in non-contact states?
Right now, it's only there's an interstate contract on juvenile systems that would cover those who ran away, this kind of thing. But if we had placed a child in another state and the placement failed and it was a non-contact state, basically, if we did not have a courtesy arrangement with that state that we could depend on, we would have to either send someone to get the child or somehow arrange long distance with other people to put the child in a plane or something and pay for it. But we would not have, that state would not have an obligation to provide the same kind of supervision, care, or responsibility for the child that we would want. Oregon has
a contact state.
That's right. And Oregon has been very good. We have, I know that when I was with the various agencies, that there were a number of cases where children would come in from out of state with an adequate plan.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we have always taken, a very good attitude toward the
mm-hmm.
children that have gone to the extent necessary to provide them with the same kind of protection and supervision that we provide to Oregon Native
mm-hmm.
children. But unfortunately, we don't have the same kind of secure feeling about children that we might send out of state to some states, particularly if there's a tremendous distance involved and they could just disappear. And when we have children that are signed under court orders, we do have certain responsibilities and we can't take those kinds of chances unless we have some security that they will be provided supervision in the state.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But when our children go to another state, is there any provision for appointing a guardian or something who can get consent for health care?
For health care? I think I would have to draw upon some of the agency people here. It's been a little while since I've been in the state, and I'm not really sure. And I haven't been able to complete it.
Thank you. I also have copies of my testimony here. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly welcome the interruption that Senator Roberts has given you a very accurate picture. I might address some of the questions that weren't touched on. One has to do with the child I was describing comes in informally without the formal arrangement by an agency and is not known to the Children's Services Division or any other agency in this state. It first becomes known to us because of the breakdown of the placement we're in. If the child is in California, very likely we're not going to get much cooperation about returning the child. We've actually, in our court, use county funds to send the child back to his placement where his father was living because he wanted to be with his father, only to have the authorities in that community, which is in California, return the child back to us where there were no relatives. We wound up having fine jurisdiction and placed the child in custody the Children's Services Division of the state. This kind of experience leaves a rather bitter taste in your mouth, and you're kind of just concerned about kids. The other thing is that our courts, there would be only two ways that I could think of for without this bill to provide for child medical care, and that would be either for the child to be found within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court and for the juvenile court to appoint someone guardian, or to go through probate court and have a guardian appointed through the probate process. It's a cumbersome method, and I think I'm saying the court does have the authority to appoint a guardian, but it's a cumbersome process. In my practice as a social worker, I discourage the use of the court where you can work with parties consensually and voluntarily, because I believe that to the degree the court's involved, you reduce the amount of control families have over their own affairs. And where a family is willing to participate in a responsible and voluntary way, I encourage that. So that when we have a situation set up that requires the penetration of the court into the privacy of the family and the control of the family, I believe our system is not operating properly. So, I guess that I just wanted to emphasize that the National Association of Social Workers, the Oregon chapter, is for this bill, and I think for many good and sufficient reasons. Participation in the bill, I think, would make us more honest with regard to our placement out of state, and would certainly protect us in some measure from the incursion into our system by the placement irresponsibly of out of state children in our state. Thank you. I believe there are about 24 now, but I could not handle them all. We're working toward it. We've supported it to the best of my knowledge in every state where it's well, I went to say Senator Cliff Crow from my district and encouraged him to participate in this, and I noticed that he's a co-sponsor. I believe we have been doing so forever.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Michael McKean.
I'm Michael McKean, and I'm the Assistant Director of Voiceville Aid Society of Oregon. I'm here to say a few words against Senate Bill 161. I understand that our Children's Service Division and other agencies would be in favor of it, certainly often in the spirit of interstate cooperation, and that's usually a good thing. However, it places the emphasis on restricting the activities of licensed private agencies. I think there is good reason to have laws that govern the placement of children by individuals across state lines or in state. However, it's not the private agencies, the licensed agencies, that are engaging in abuses. There are a few war stories that occurred with other states placing children in Oregon, I understand. This is not a common practice, but it has occurred. We feel it's extremely important to be able to deal directly with legitimate licensed agencies in other states to plan for children across state lines. Our only agency does encourage agencies in other states to to work with it, and to do so with the state having to provide prior approval, written prior approval, would make the process much more cumbersome. Frankly, one of our major concerns is that bottlenecks will occur within CSD. I'm not here to criticize them, but I know full well that when new steps are added and new papers have to be processed, that oftentimes things bog down. I feel very strongly that we do not need to have to process every case through the Children's Service Division. I do feel that if agencies, licensed agencies in Oregon, are engaging in improper placement practices, that the Children's Service Division ought to attend to that through the existing licensing laws, and that there is not sufficient reason to, there are not sufficient abuses in terms of numbers for the state to regulate every and supervise every single case of a child coming into Oregon from another state. Again, I'd like to say that we have no question whatsoever about the need to regulate and supervise placements by individuals. However, I do not feel that it makes sense to place another restriction on the activities of prior agencies.
Could you give an example of how this might restrict the operation of your agency and an agency in another state? Hypothetical?
Well, I would give you an example of that. It would be hypothetical. I can't point to a particular case.
But since the contract is in effect.
If we, for example, were to be working with an agency in Ohio or some other state, and it was an adoption kind of situation.
A child going which way?
A child coming from that state to Oregon.
Right.
And if we had encouraged that agency to work with us, and if we did have a home in Oregon that was prepared for that child, in terms of the placement process, timing is very important. You know, the family is prepared, the older child, a particular child is prepared to move at a certain time. You have to tell the other agency that they must secure written approval from Oregon and provide certain guarantees, and that then we must then wait for the state to give us the okay. It really stops the process, that it says in a way that the private agency, which has the most information about the family, about the child, and about the adequacy of the placement, has to wait for a third party to intervene and provide a stamp of approval. When that third party doesn't have the information on which to make that sort of decision, unless they made their own investigation. And that's the sort of thing that I guess I'm most concerned about, that at some point down the road, the state might see the need to send one of its own caseworkers out, not to look into the situation and see whether it's truly a proper placement. I think that the compact, even though it's extremely well intended, and I have no question about that, goes too far in requiring that in each and every case, someone else, a third party, the state agency, must make its own decision as to whether the placement is proper or not. I think, I'm not sure that's an example, it's kind of a long example, but that's the kind of thing that I think will happen.
And if you think of comfort is sort of clear that once you notify foreign services, it means that you're receiving the child, there'll be a little sense of how to deal. But it will go through the foreign services, and that's all we just said.
I would hope so, Senator, that would be the way it would work out. And I have no reason to doubt my friends and colleagues at Children's Services that can tell me the same thing. But indeed, it would be a rubber stamp kind of process.
But wouldn't you be on the other hand concerned about where a child is sent from your place to the United States?
Well,
or wouldn't you like to have someone in the United States assuring you that when that child goes to the United States, that that child is going to be safe?
Oh, indeed, yes. And I think that's the kind of planning that license agencies do in most cases. Again, it isn't the license agency which engages in the improper placement, child placement practices. It's individuals, unlicensed people. And I think that's where the regulations should be focused and where the supervision should occur. I don't think that anyone in Children's Services would send out social workers to reinvestigate the placements we make. I am concerned about what's going to happen 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now when somebody may decide it's their job to really ride herd on the license agencies and to make sure that in every case there's an investigation of some kind. I am deeply concerned about the paperwork load that already exists within public agencies and the possibility that might lead to bottlenecks and that the placement process will be held up to many cases. I would have no concern about the bill if there were a provision in it for the exclusion of private agencies. There are some exclusions in here. I think children moving from one state to another to obtain medical treatment, I think, and other kinds of services. So I would suggest that the legitimate private agencies be included in that group.
Well, I
don't
understand. Do you see a way to
write this out loud? Yes. I can't point to it right away, but I think that there are some exclusions in the bill that make it unnecessary for the state agency to provide approval. And I could see that the licensed private agencies might be included there. I think it's Article 2, Section D. Placement means the arrangement of the care for the care of a child in a family, free, or boarding home, or in a child caring agency or institution. That does not include any institution caring for the mentally ill, affected, or epileptic, or any institution primarily educational in character, in any hospital or other medical facility. I think that might be a place in which the private agency should be included.
Good question,
sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Kim. Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm Joe Kim from the Children's Services Division. Senator, I've asked through the hearing this morning two representatives from the American Public Welfare Association in Washington, D.C. With the chairman's approval, I'd like to ask the chairman to sit at the table to respond to the specific detailed questions on the interstate contact of members of the committee might have.
Okay.
Mr. Brendan Callanan, C-A-L-L-A-N, and Dr. Mitchell Wendell. Mr. Callanan is with the American Public Welfare Association on a special grant that has been provided by HEW to work with states who are interested in exploring the possibility of the passage of a bill on the Interstate Compact. Dr. Wendell has been for many years in private practice in consultation on intergovernmental, interstate kinds of matters. Many years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting him when he was staff consul to the Council of State Governments. He is a person with considerable expertise in this area, and in fact was at least one of the authors of this particular compact on placement of children. And both of these gentlemen have come out here on the, fortunately reimbursed by the grant, to appear this morning. Now, I have, in preparation for the introduction of this bill, which the Children's Services Division gives a high priority, I've had a number of contacts with representatives of the private agencies, including Mr. Matern and Mr. Stimmel, who is the director of the Boys and Girls Aid Society.
Are you prepared to write the knowledge bill?
No, not at
Why
all.
Why not?
Because I think that the specific concerns that they have about becoming involved in a bureaucratic tangle of the Children's Services Division impeding the process is not, it's really a fear that is unfounded. And I'd like to give you some reasons why.
For keeping children in detention, in Multnomah for 6 months. What thought is there that there's going to be two different processes through this one?
I think we're talking, as you know, Senator, about two entirely different kinds of situations. The concerns of the adoption agency, representatives of which met here in Salem yesterday for a number of hours with both Mr. Callanan and Dr. Wendell, worked through many of the questions. I don't think that there was 100% satisfaction, but I think many of the questions and concerns that the representatives of the private adoption agencies have were responded to in that meeting. Mm-hmm. One of the other perspectives that I would like to provide is that we're not talking about adoption alone. We're talking about the gamut of child welfare services. Foster care placement in residential kinds of programs on an interstate basis. So adoption is one facet of a total complex of interstate kinds of arrangements. Now, in response to my earlier contact with Mr. Stimmel of the Boys and Girls Aid Society around the concern of private agencies getting involved in the state getting involved in the compact, I wrote to the Child Welfare League of America, which is the national standard-setting organization to which most of the respected and respectable private agencies have membership. This is the letter I received from the Child Welfare League Director of Information Services. I wrote my letter to Mr. Reed, who is the Executive Director. At Mr. Reed's request, I am glad to reply to your letter of December 17th concerning voluntary agency reaction to the Interstate Compact on the placement of children. I have raised this question on Mr. Stimmel's concern that private agencies in other parts of the country were experiencing difficulties in those states that had adopted the compact. To the knowledge of several of us who are in the office today, we have received no particular criticism of the compact from the private agency sector. As our staff returns after the holiday, I shall make additional inquiries. If we find negative reaction, you will hear from me. Otherwise, you will know the Child Welfare League of America has not received criticism from the voluntary sector. That letter was written 2 months ago.
I asked you what reason there was to think that Children's Services in Oregon would facilitate the necessary consent and faster than it gets them out of detention in Mount Lomond.
Because I think we're dealing in the main with entirely different situations, and I can elaborate. I think that we are in the instance of the adoption situations that the private agencies are engaged in, and outside of the whole agency, we identified 81 interstate adoptions, that is, adoptions of youngsters that were placed in the state of Oregon from other states with private and our own agency involved in 1974, 81 adoptions. The interstate compact arrangement is really quite simple in terms of the sign-off that is required of the state agency. My feeling is that where we license a state agency to engage in adoption practices in the state of Oregon, the Boys and Girls Aid Society being one of the five or six, that we can, for all practical purposes, develop a secondary agreement with those agencies to guarantee that when they approve of an interstate placement, that is tantamount to the Children's Services Division approving and making that placement itself. I think that can be a secondary agreement with these private agencies, and from my point of view, we will not impede this kind of placement. There are situations that exist where we have youngsters in detention, Multnomah County or Lane County or anywhere else. I think a vastly different situation. We're dealing with the complex problem of trying to find alternate community resources for this youngster to fit into. And these interstate placements and adoption, 99% of the time, the placement is already made and arranged and is available to the youngster. I think it would destroy the integrity of the compact itself.
So, two questions. Is it more important to protect the children or protect the integrity of the compact?
I don't think that the two are divergent. I think they're the same.
Well, you're not suggesting that this is the Holy Grail and the present company notwithstanding, that we are bound by it, and if Oregon chooses to go a different direction, if we deem it to be a better interest to the children or of the people of the state, we're certainly free to take those parts of it that we want and move in other directions.
I think that is a technical question, Senator, that perhaps Dr. Wendell could respond to if you...
I'd like to, because I have general disagreements with our uniform state laws, because they're uniformly bad, and I have not read this compact, so I don't need to speak to it, but yes, I'd like to answer the question. I heard over my shoulder the answer is you're not free to
I'm Dr. Mitchell Wendell. I'm consultant to the American Public Welfare Association, particularly with reference to the provision of technical and legal services for the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children. Senator has indicated a dislike of uniform state laws. That is a philosophic position that I'm sure he can maintain and that he has some company in. Yet there are others who like uniform laws very well. The Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children is not a uniform state law. It is an interstate compact. You and Oregon have quite a bit of experience with interstate compacts in many fields. However, this matter of the changes that you can and cannot make in the bill, as many of you know, and you have enacted in Oregon many interstate compacts, an interstate compact is not only a statute in the enacting state, it's a contract among states. And for that reason, actually, the question before you can't be whether you want to change its text or not. Because if you change its text, then you have not agreed to the same contract as the other states that are participating in it. And so the effect of such change would be that you would not be entering into it. Now, there are, as been said earlier this morning, 24 states, as of right now, that have enacted the compact and that are functioning under it. In all of them, the language of the compact is identical, as indeed it must be, for the reasons that I just explained. And many of those states are not really all that different from Oregon, and they have testified to its workability and to its desirability. So I think the first thing for you to consider is that if you dislike the compact because of what it says, then you ought to vote it down. If, on the other hand, you do consider that it would be an advance, then you would want to enact it as it is, otherwise you can't have it with the other states because you wouldn't have a contractual arrangement with them.
And from
my dim past, dimly in my past, the compact had to be approved by Congress. Is that, you know, I just way off base? The only compact I know we have are dealing with boundaries and various other things of their states, and they're not affecting to approve in the true sense of the compact. I must be off base because
you're partly correct. The compact clause of the Constitution of the United States, which is Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, does appear to say you can't have a compact without the consent of Congress. However, through a long line of judicial construction, including a number of leading cases in the United States Supreme Court, there is an important fundamental distinction made. There are certain types of compacts which need the consent of Congress, and those which do not. If you want to pursue that in the next couple of minutes, I can go into this in probably more detail in Committee 1, but until you ask further questions, suffice it to say that this compact is of the type that does not need the consent of Congress to come into effect. Oregon is party to a large number of cases, many of which have the specific consent of Congress, and others of which belong to the same class as this compact on the interstate placement of children and do not have such consent. Among the latter group is the interstate compact on juveniles, which Oregon, along with all other of the 50 states, are party to and have been for a considerable number of years, so that this compact is in effect, it does not require the consent of Congress.
Thank you. Do you have anything further, Dr.
Wendland,
if you want to?
Yes, I would, Chairman and members of the committee, like to make a few comments on some of the things that have been asked previously this morning in the hearing. In the first place, a number of your questions as to procedurally how it might be possible to have a guardian for health care or for other reasons and so on are important questions, and I think the way really to understand them briefly in connection with the compact is this. The interstate compact on the placement of children does not presume to write the child caring laws or the child care institution licensing laws of the state. The substantive law relating to children and virtually all of the procedures which an individual state might wish to employ with respect to handling children's affairs are not touched by the compact. Your child care codes in Oregon and in the other states remain as they are and would with the compact, and you would change them separately from the compact by amendment whenever you, in this legislature, might wish to do so. The compact deals only with one very narrow but important subject matter, and that is the interstate relationship when Oregon law and administration cannot reach all of a placement transaction by virtue of the fact that part of that transaction takes place in another state. And that's the only subject matter that the compact deals with, this interstate relationship. And it hooks right into whatever the child care law is in whatever state one happens to be dealing with. And I think that's an important key to something that you were questioning Mr. McKern about. It's very true that in Oregon here, as in the other states, your child licensing, your child agency licensing laws are useful and do accomplish a desirable measure of regulation, and I take it Mr. McBurn was not opposed to that. He was relying on it. The difficulty in the situations that we're talking about is that your Oregon licensing law, like your other child care laws, does not have any significant extraterritorial effect. The agencies of which Mr. McKern are speaking do not necessarily have in other states the facilities to behave as they behave here in Oregon, if they are Oregon-based agencies. And you don't have, under your licensing laws, and can't very well have, a jurisdiction to regulate their conduct or their omissions outside of the state of Oregon. And this is also true of each of the other states, so far as activities that some agencies may engage in within Oregon. Now, the compact is the interjurisdictional bridge and does provide the procedures that your unilateral child licensing or other laws cannot provide. And I think also another one of the very important aspects of Mr. McBurn's here is that I would much more appreciate his point of view if this were a new compact, and if we were trying to speculate about how things would be if it were adopted. The compact was adopted by the first place of state almost 15 years ago now. It's been in operation. There have been tens of thousands of interstate instances handled under it. And there are thousands every year handled under it now. And we know that it does not delay adoptions or pre-adoptive or foster care placements. In fact, the states and the private agencies, both in it, have had the experience that in many instances it speeds them up because it makes more certain what the situation is in the other state and what the rights and responsibilities are in the other state. Now, further, the child care agencies and the child placement agencies throughout the country, after the 10 years or more of experience under the compact, every place where we've gone, the licensed child caring agencies in the state have appeared in favor of this legislation, not against it. Now, they studied it too. The Catholic Charities, which is a national organization of child placing agencies, many of the other religious charities, many of the secular ones. In the state of California, when this bill was before the legislature in 1974, its most energetic supporters were the licensed private child care agencies. As a result, I think that there ought to weigh very heavily in the balance the fact that there is a lot of experience under this compact, and it is uniformly good. And it also indicates that there is not this type of delay or excessive red tape that some appear to fear.
Thank you, Jeff. Will you introduce your other guest, please?
It's Mr. Brendan Callanan, who is from the American Public Welfare Association and was actually for a time involved in the implementation or operation of the interstate compact in the state of New York. So you did explain
that.
Yes, I might just add during the period from 1969 to 1972, I was an administrative child welfare services in New York. And of course, New York was the first state to ratify the compact back in 1960. We were able to identify that the placements that we were making between and among compact states very definitely were speedier and much more efficient to execute than those placements that were being made into non-compact states. We had the problems of non-compact states with importation statutes, Postal Reform, and the obtaining of pre-placement investigations. We did not have this problem when the other state involved was a compact state. Now, we also found strong disadvantages in working with non-compact states, and we literally tried to avoid making placements there if we could. For example, the state of California, as a matter of policy and their regulations, every so often promulgates the viewpoint, the policy of their department of children that they have in foster care outside of the state of California. They will not pay for their support, care, maintenance, and treatment. And what this has resulted in has been states literally stuck, or children dumped, where California has unilaterally withdrawn their obligation. They have a double standard there in California now that they're in the compact. They do not do this with states where they place children that are in fact parties to the interstate compact and place the children. They maintain it as their responsibility and they make their payments. So what we've seen very dramatically and very quickly with California and also with Illinois and Florida that have recently come in is children aren't asked to be dumped and walked away from. There is nothing paperwork-wise about the compact itself that inherently would slow it down. Again, if anything, it should speed it up because in the absence of the compact, the problem has always been the Child Welfare League of America has done study upon study of this whole issue of interstate placement. They recently, well, August of 1972, released a study titled Obstacles to Interstate Adoption. The conclusion that they reached was that, quote, no one is in charge. You have conflicting laws and diverse administrative requirements among the states. And what has happened in the past is that a worker who may be trying to work out a placement spends weeks, on occasions literally months, finding out what the legal and administrative requirements are in another state. The consequence has been that very often they throw up their hand, they walk away from it, it's too time consuming. The child is continued in foster care, and he's discharged from foster care when he reaches the age of majority.
We have other witnesses and other bills to work on today, and Mr. Kim is available to us at any time. I think we'll call Mr. Kim back at another time, but he has questions for these two gentlemen from Washington.
I would appreciate if Dr. Wendell would provide me briefly with the cases that you indicated that it's a smattering up until I can see that at the beginning. Not right now, if you would. Maybe you can give them to Joe and
fine.
But I would like to pursue it, and I appreciate you being thoughtful.
Okay, fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kim.
My name is Dave Kim. I represent the Orthodoxy program using Oregon. I'm a New Zealand Oregon resident and a associate director of the program. Before the information class, I just said something about our program and the connection with this interstate compact. And of course, the whole has been in operation since 1956. We have been placed. There's over 10,000 children in the United States, and that's all 50 states plus the two United States territories. And since the licensing of the agency at the child placement agency in 1962, we placed over 3,000 children to them. And the last year alone, we placed 1,900 children throughout the United States that was in about 47 states. And of course, we operating under the premise that every child of whatever nation or the race has the right to grow up with the parents of his own. And we've been operating in the two foreign countries right now, in Vietnam and Korea, mainly. And we have been placing some children in Europe as well, the number about 4,000. And we are beginning to place some children in Australia and some other countries and out of Vietnam. The experience in working with the other state agency has been quite positive. I think that's the kind of interstate contact that I'm talking about today. I wish that it come much earlier time that we had such a difficult time establishing our working relationship. They're talking so much about this the state relationship so much. I think we were in a dire need of that kind of help at the time. We just simply was not able to solicit any kind of help. But earlier this was drafted back in 1969, when I came in state yesterday. Hope that it came at that time. But since then, we have gone through a lot of agonizing moments and the consistent the effort working with the different states and try to establish working relationships. And with our efforts and our genuine concern and sincerity and working with them as a partner, we have gained the trust to establish some with the working relationships. And this was able to place all this number of children throughout the United States. And the hope has been that placing children under some kind of contractual basis, some kind of an agreement. And our statistic shows that about 10 states in the United States required the agreement to support the priority of each placement. So we do sign the agreement. And in some states, we even have to post a bond on the two states. And a few other states, I think it's called about 7, including the posting, requiring the posting of the bond. We have to make some kind of statement that we do take the children out when the placement does not work out. But all other states that we are operating under the premise that we're a good state, and we are just in a matter of notifying our intention and our work. And we just simply send a carbon copy of the correspondence to the agency that we are working in each state, and that's the each state requirement. And because of that, then I don't think that adding any law at this point. I think that this interstate contact not really have enhanced any quality of the services or kind of the placement we were doing at this time. And this might this is perhaps in my eyes, I think that my experience with this the situation for past several years, that this sort of thing could provide some uniformity of procedures and things that sort. But in a way that, on the other side of it, was they're giving us much more the paperwork and delay, as we see Mr. Rathen from the Boys and Girls have indicated earlier. And it has been our experience that any state is only a 10, but when we submit this kind of agreement and to sign some of these papers, and it does require sometimes 6 to 4 weeks, because the time is the essence on the placement such as ours, and that creates some problem. I think we have so much of paperwork to do and all of us, we are swamped with this whole thing, and I think to us this type of a deal might just create another bureaucratic red tape rather than to really service to the child or the agency. So you can see that our concern is that reflected from our own experience. I don't think that it really would help. Maybe it would help in a way of the dollars and cents to the state, but in fact, the service to children and other areas, I don't really see that it would help, because as an agency, licensed agency, that we do go to rather rigorous the process of finding who are the qualified agencies. Even though we do have a licensed private agency working in some states, we always contact state agencies. In fact, this agency is reputable. is able to provide this type of service. These sort of things are already built in, and we find that it's very useful. I think that we are our present the situation and working with all the different stages so well. I don't know that this type of the bill would help or add any the added advantage. And so I feel that because of our experience, I don't think that this is really relevant. And because I'm only speaking in the one area, because as you may know, in adoption, the foster placement and possibility of adoption, and I'm not talking about the category of number one or two, perhaps is the foster the home placement or the title, the fifth type of placement, so I would understand that.
Thank you, Mr. Ms. Kim, do I understand that you would prefer to be written out of the your adoption agency?
Yes, I think that's what we'd like to. We are in a way that is not really in the this option, but the thing that when child comes to family in the Eastern State, they are looked upon as the agents who holds the custody. That's that we come into this kind of interstate contact. We place a large number of children. And this type of thing might delay and create extra the paperwork and the added burden. Of course, so we are trying to be efficient, and the waiting are so long, and the process of the pet family going to are so the arduous. I don't think that the right for us to add another.
When you say children, Arden, you have a hearing with children, children.
Yes, ma'am. Not great. We are the Oregon agency. We work closely with the adoption department, Father David, and we have horizontal contact inside of some of their opinions and good special advice and so forth and so on. In some time that in some area, the hold is not able to reach, and we if the state has a facility, we do sometimes request as a service, but this has been quite rare because we didn't have too many applicants from those areas, and that's when the time we have.
You don't have a relationship with them if you request them?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I please say this? Yes. Thank you. Are there any other persons who want to testify? I'm going to go 161. That will end hearing in 161. if you turn to Senate Bill 87.
Yes, I think Robert Chu asked whether or not this mechanics and materialman lien would apply to personal case as well as realty. And it's my opinion that it wouldn't. You should have in your packet a statement of what, or a definition of what an improvement is, which is the property to which the lien applies. And I would base my opinion on several things. First of all, there are already other statutes that apply to chattels or personalty as opposed to this particular lien. The language of the definition of improvement. And some of the cases, I might add that some very old cases have applied this to a boat, which is personal fee. But in those cases, the question as to whether or not the lien would apply was not really the issue that the court addressed. It was the question which they addressed was whether or not the lien applied to public property, and the boat was determined to be public property. But the more recent cases, for the most part, look at the improvement that was made and ask whether or not it's a fixture, it's a realty. And based on that, as well as the other statutes that are provided whereby a materialman can place a lien on personalty, I think that this would be considered to apply only to realty or things that are fixed to realty.
We also have a proposed amendment.
That amendment, Madam Chairman, the committee adopted already at the last meeting, and it simply allows the owner of the property to receive notice whenever the material man or mechanic can test the adequacy of the bond that the owner has posted. So it gives him an opportunity to come in and be heard in opposition to the mechanic or material man's argument.
And what's this bill
attached to? That's a House bill which is a fairly comprehensive revision of the lien laws, and there's a possible conflict here. I don't think I've looked at it. Basically, the House bill does, in other language, the same thing which this particular bill does, insofar as making or giving attorney's fees to the prevailing party. The other language in Senate Bill 87 is incorporated verbatim into House Bill 2336, but it applies to other liens besides this mechanic and material lien as well. The only difference between sections 2 through 8 in Senate Bill 87 from the sections in this other bill is that the other bill provides that the bond which is posted shall be in an amount not less than 150% of the amount claimed under the lien, or in the amount of $1,000, whichever is greater. That, or in the amount of $1,000, whichever is greater, is the only difference in the language. That would say, if you look at Senate Bill 87, that language would be inserted on page 3, section 3, subsection 1. If you look at the last sentence in subsection 1, the bond shall be in an amount not less than 150% of the amount claimed under the lien. The House bill would add there, or in the amount of $1,000, whichever is greater. I might say that the House bill is still in judiciary and they haven't acted upon it yet. I don't know.
Madam Chairman, Jack Kalinowski is coming in with two thoughts, merely for clarification. But I think at least one of them is, at least the minutes ought to reflect, and I'm speaking on page 3, line 22, particularly 23. The court in which any proceeding to propose a lien may be brought may, upon notice and upon motion by the depositor. Are we referring, in the depositor is the one who is, used to be called the owner. Is that clear that it just changes from the, it starts section 3.1 says the owner and improvement, and then he becomes the depositor. And are we clear we're talking about the same person? I presume we are. I assume we are that he raised that issue.
I think it's fairly clear that it is Senator Carson, because in section 3.1 it begins where you're talking about the posting of a bond, it begins the owner of the improvement or land. And then in section 2A, in lieu of the surety bond provided in subsection 1, a person may deposit. That person, that
the person there would refer back to the owner of the improvement of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to D, where you've got something that is equivalent to money. When you're talking about depositor, I think it's going to refer back to the owner of an improvement or land. I don't think there'd be any difficulty in.
Okay, it might have been tidier if it had said that upon motion by the owner making the deposit or something like that. But okay, I'm not, as long as we're all clear that the depositor refers to the owner who has made the deposit. The other one, in section 4 that he raised on line 32, says a notice of filing or deposit and, if a bond, a copy thereof. My understanding, his concern was, is that easy to come by? My understanding is, yes, it would only indicate a at the very minimum a photocopy of the bond, at the very most a certified copy of the bond, and it would not appear to me to be a serious problem. Do we all agree to that?
I would agree to that.
So I don't think that's a real problem, but I think you can get a copy of the bond relatively easy. Okay.
I'm looking real. Discussion of the motion.
Would it clarify the situation? I think it would, of course, to change in section 3, 2A, that word a person to owner, and then change the use of the word depositor in subsection B to owner in those two places where it occurs, just to keep the language.
Yeah, the following motion.
I'll make that following motion. It'll be line 19, change a person to the owner, and lines 23, 24, and 26, change depositor to the word owner.
Is there an objection to the motion?
Well, if we're going to change that, then on line 19, a person to the owner may deposit.
Mm-hmm.
So
I did.
You mentioned that.
I mentioned that.
Okay,
yeah. Change a person to the owner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there's no objection, the amendment is adopted. Further discussion on the bill. Clerk call roll.
Deputy Brown.
Aye.
Harrison.
Aye.
Robert Owen.
Mary Jane.
Aye.
229.
I think I have an understanding of it, yes.
Yeah, I didn't take time. I proposed amendment, John.
If you look in your packet, you should have a letter from Mr. Gisbold, and it's the letter is the heading of it is Hardy Butler, McEwen, Weiss, and Newman. This is Mr. Gisbold proposes an amendment. I don't know whether he's here today or not. That's not. It doesn't exactly relate to the directly to the amendments that are made in the bill by the sponsors of the bill. But basically, the problem that he addresses is this: the Supreme Court, Oregon Supreme Court, has in its ruling said this. That whenever somebody goes into bankruptcy and they declare a homestead, $7,500, any liens or judgment liens on that homestead survive the bankruptcy. In other words, once a person declared bankrupt, the lien remains on whatever property that the person declared bankrupt declared a homestead. The Supreme Court has also said that in any case where whether somebody declares bankruptcy or not, a lien will survive a conveyance of property on which a person has declared homestead. So in other words, under the Supreme Court ruling, the creditor could execute on a lien once property is transferred. He could go to the property even after it has been transferred by the debtor and execute on the lien in order to get any excess over the homestead. The same situation, say, if somebody is bankrupt and they continue to have the property. If they try to convey it, then the creditor could go to the purchaser of the property and still execute on his lien. What happens is that evidently it's to the advantage of the creditor to wait, and with the hope that the property will appreciate and that there will be some excess above and beyond, say, the homestead allowance. That means that the debtor then has a difficult time conveying the property because title insurance companies are unwilling to insure title because of this cloud on title. That whenever, say, somebody, a debtor, transfers property for a value that is less than the homestead plus the amount of the lien, there's always the possibility that the property is going to appreciate and the creditor is going to come in and execute on the land. And so title insurance companies are very reluctant to issue insurance in these situations. That's the problem that Mr. Giswold is trying to get at. And he proposes an amendment which would say that for the purposes of determining whether or not a creditor is going to be able to move against the property, you look at the property value at the time that a person goes through bankruptcy, or the value at the time that the property is conveyed. In other words, a creditor would not be able to move against, say, the purchaser of the property. But he's going to look at the value then, and the creditor is foreclosed from the possibility of the property appreciating after that time. And he's got to, if there is no excess over the homestead at that time, then the creditor is simply out. That's true. I don't know whether that speaks against the amendment or not, but that would be the effect, yes. There would be a cloud on title on more properties. I would think so, yes.
Mr. Horst, did you want to address the amendment?
Well, I support it, and I've discussed this amendment with Judge Donald Sullivan of the Bankruptcy Court, also with Sam Johnson, who is the chairman of the Debtor Creditor Committee of the Bar, also with Mr. Ed Murphy, who is the attorney for the debtor on the Everett and Bay case, which this amendment is addressed to, and all of them think it's a good amendment and that will do the job, and that it's necessary. And Judge Sullivan has some few questions as to whether the validity of the opinion in view of the Supreme Court case and in view of some amendments to Section 17 of the Bankruptcy Act. And so this amendment will cure all the problems that are raised by the Everett and Bay case.
That would be, if you look at page 5 and 6 of the bill, it would be under section 4 of the bill. You would be adding at the bottom of page 5 a subsection 4.
And that's the actual wording of that amendment appears where? I'm sorry. Right.
Did you want to discuss the possibility of establishing the value at a different time?
Well, I do this reluctantly because I'm not that familiar with bankruptcy law, mm-hmm. but I think there is an alternative that the committee might want to consider, and that is to simply have the value of the property set at the time the property is conveyed, regardless of whether or not a person is bankrupt. The effect of that alternative would seem to me to be to cut more in favor of the creditor than, say, the debtor. Currently, I would say the Supreme Court, Oregon Supreme Court ruling protects the creditor very much as opposed to the debtor. This amendment proposed by Mr. Giswold would protect the debtor very much, and I suppose the middle ground would be an amendment to the effect that the time at which you determine the value of the property would be the time at which it's conveyed, regardless of whether or not a person is bankrupt.
Well, that would solve the same problem. That would provide a cutoff time, which is just for the problem which makes it difficult to convey. Obviously, I'm on a debtor's side, but it would solve the problem that exists.
We have 1 minute
as
far as
if you have both occur and it'll say which of the two attain.
That I would think, this is going to raise, this would raise problems of interpretation.
Well,
certainly the debtor is going to say the person who declares bankruptcy or is declared bankrupt is certainly going to argue that he has the option to determine what date, and he's going to select the date the petition of the bankruptcy was filed. Assuming, say, the property is going to appreciate greater and greater.
Well,
so
then
And you're probably, any time, say, the property is going to depreciate, you're probably talking about an even greater cloud on title, I suppose, right?
Well, I didn't see that.
So, in a sense,
it would have to be on the date of the filing of the petition of bankruptcy, not on the date of property.
Right, so it's a different bill, I don't know.
Right. This is always paying the mortgage, it's kind of far.
Okay, I would move in, Chairman, that we reduce the act from the word or the rest of that. The petition, just to determine if the date of petition of bankruptcy is filed.
Did you want to also then say, delete that or conveys his homestead in the first phrase?
Yeah. In line one and two. Right.
So the amendment now reads, when the owner of the homestead goes through bankruptcy, the value of the homestead shall be determined as of the date of petition in bankruptcy is filed.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. The only problem, maybe I'm not understanding of, but the other problem is you still haven't solved the problem of the cloud on title, say where you've got a debtor who has not gone through bankruptcy, who wants to convey property on which he's going to claim a homestead. Under the Supreme Court rulings, that those liens are going to shift to the purchaser of the property, and he's still not going to be too enthusiastic about buying the property.
You have that attachment on the property.
Yeah. If you strike out this language relating to conveyance, you haven't solved the problem raised by Mr. Gisbold where a person does not declare bankruptcy, but he is a debtor and he wants to convey property on which judgment liens have attached. You're still going to have a cloud on title so long as the property is left town, your homestead plus the value of the lien.
Well, I think it brings in some detailed hearings. How do you
get into it? Yeah, I got to look out for the valve.
Mr. Forrester, you can come.
Well, I think that Dean Gisbold's amendment does deal with that problem. It gives no alternative. It goes through bankruptcy or conveys the property. The bankruptcy or conveying the property are not related. They're two separate alternatives. And therefore, as is, amendment as is, perhaps there may be some clarification towards the end.
If we say specifically, after conveys his homestead, that it is the result of a judgment lien. For example, instead of deleting that language, when the owner of a homestead goes to bankruptcy or conveys his homestead as a result of a judgment lien, the value of the homestead should be returned as the day of taking bankruptcy, such as the bankruptcy, or the files were filed, or the second day of conveyance. The conveyance then relates back to the judgment lien. We're dealing with two different distinct situations in the paragraph, and we might separate paragraphs, might make one in bankruptcy and one in
separate
paragraph. Yeah, and make one in separate paragraph. I just want to say something that would be more simple.
Could you say that again, please?
Make two separate paragraphs. One would be for bankruptcy. And that would be the value being determined at the time the petition was filed. On the conveyance, because of the lien,
I don't understand what you mean when you say conveyance because of the lien.
He's selling it.
Yes, but would he sell it because of a lien?
Would he sell it just to pay off the debtor without a court proceeding to order him to do so?
He might, yeah. I mean, he might, debtor may, for some reason, want to, for any reason, might decide to sell the thing.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, there has to be language taken into consideration of that sort of situation, if you're voluntarily or if you're the reason for it.
Or why not simply say it any conveyance, regardless of what the, we could put in two paragraphs, one dealing with the bankruptcy and the other dealing with any conveyance, regardless of the reason for it.
Then would be the value of the conveyance.
That would be basically the thought of this original paragraph four, except it would have put it in two paragraphs.
I think it's much more understandable, and it does eliminate the ambiguity of who's going to select what time.
Yeah, the only thing that I'm saying for the title company's records, it might be better if you put it in the one statute where you went through proceeding, even though it didn't take place, and then the title company could look at the records and say, this was set aside. How are you going to effectively determine what the determination was of this homestead exemption if you have no proceeding to determine? There's a procedure in the statute now that only takes effect when levy takes place. The title company can do something that can look at on the record where the interested party is going to.
But yeah, this is one for, if the RMP can work it out with, is that right?
Sure, work it out with the city of Denver.
Judge Summers is, I believe, still with the RMC Bar this week, and we could probably volunteer his help.
Right.
I'd be glad to help you work it out. I didn't come up to participate in this. I'm saying the title companies really like something they can look at on the record. You don't want to make it too difficult for the creditors to think they do something there.
We can accept the 188.
Were there other amendments?
I'm going to have a few on 229. I'd like to discuss the possibility on the vehicle. On page 2, they jump from 400 to 800 and from 800 to 1600. I think the problem, I'm not so much worried about the value as I am about the joint ownership. And I think we have testimony that at least some judges are taking the position that if the vehicle is jointly held, then you get to double that. So presently we're talking about 800 and 1600, and if we double that again and don't settle that issue, we may be talking about 1600 and 3200. And although I think we did have testimony that cars are not very attractive anymore anyway, the subject matter for execution. But I think that we ought to address that question of whether they can double up on their ownership of the automobile. I don't care which way we land on it, but which way is how we interpret it determines whether I want to work on the 800 and the 1600 or the 400.
Doesn't that apply to everything in there almost? Except the clothing? Most animals wouldn't apply to the same way as the double line.
Well, it conceivably could, but I think the issue registers that. I mean, that's a good point. Maybe we ought to get it stopped. Forces perhaps might be able to help us.
Well, I was expecting to say something. Domestic animals only is applied to the family you use.
Right.
And
the practical way it's handled on vehicles. If you have a joint filing bankruptcy estate, you're consolidated. And usually there's two cars in the family, and one takes an equity in one, and the other takes an equity in the other. If there was only one car per family, then it allowed 400 in each estate at the same time. We're both going to do one.
Does that mean 800 total?
800 total. This is the policy that the Oregon U.S. District Court is taking.
Madam Chairman, maybe the thing to do while John's working on this, it's the land one side or the other. If we're gonna adopt in law the policy that the district court is following, then I'm for leaving it at 400 and 800. If on the other hand we want to do something else, not allow the doubling up, then maybe want to. Then my other concern, or the other concern, is on page 4.
Well, let's deal with this one first.
Madam Chairman?
Yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the question of doubling the amount for an automobile and equipment?
No, automobile.
Automobile? Yeah. Well, it's automobile or business equipment alternative.
Well,
just automobile.
We're talking about joint ownership.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a point I'd like to make, and on all of this thing, I think every person ought to be entitled to claim separate rights. And it's really, if we believe in individual separateness and equal rights for everybody, that a person shouldn't be penalized by being married in terms of the exemption statute. And that if we're going to allow separate ownership of separate things, each husband, each wife, each individual should be entitled to what I think probably is what the law is now, although I don't know that it's contested in the Supreme Court. I think under the law now, and I may have missed the decision, and correct me if I'm misstating what I think the law is, if there's been a decision to the contrary. I think under the law now, each person ought to be entitled to claim a $7,500 interest in land and a $400 car if, in fact, they use the car in their work. And I think that's a good policy. Maybe it's by accident in the law, but I certainly think it's a sound policy if we believe in equal rights for every individual.
Well, since
everybody's
prepared to take position on that,
what
would be another
law? Yes, Madam Chairman, on page 4, increasing the disposable earnings exemption up to 125, I think we have ample testimony that it's too high. I am ambivalent on whether to go to 925, go to, I believe it's Washington, that went to 40%. 40 times the federal minimum, or come down to some figure around 85, and I have $85 rather than 125, but I don't think I can afford 125.
What would your proposal do, Wally?
Well, I talked to Mr. Forrester, and I believe that 40 times the federal minimum hourly wage today would be around $85. Is that
right? $2.10 is the minimum wage right now. It would be up to $2.30. I believe January 1st, 1976. $2.30. So
at 2:30, it's 85.
No. Right now it's 84, and at 2:30, I believe it would be 92.
And so I would be willing to go restore the original language, delete the 125, and go to 40 times the settlement, which today would have the effect of establishing $84.
One of the concerns of mine is there any practical way to give recognition to dependency in the wage garnishment section? Has this been discussed or thought about it? It does seem to me that the whole theory of, I think I'm for a single person or a married person without any kids, I agree with you. I don't think we should go any stronger than what you're suggesting, probably. But how about if you have a person with 2, 3, 4, or 5 dependent children? This obviously $85 a week is not going to be enough to keep body and soul together. Has anyone discussed or thought about a practical alternative?
You never had the opportunity to.
Well, what if we were to, just as a suggestion, we would say that would add another 5 times or 10 times for each kid? Well, let's see. How about an additional 5 times for each dependent person, wife or child. I would so move to amend the motion an additional 5 times for each dependent.
You're saying the 40 for one dependent would be a piece of 45 and
35, 50.
The question on what the amendment is. The amendment to the amendment. Is it any discussion?
I'd like to think about that a little bit. That may be a very good way to handle it, but I think I'd like to see what it does to the increase. But that's a new thought to me. I've not heard that one before, and I would intend to vote no at this time, although I may change my mind. And because of ignorance, I'm voting no on the amendment if you add the 5.
Yeah, would you mind withdrawing your motion for the moment to give Senator Carson time to think about it?
Well,
recognizing that we're not going to vote the bill out today and we'll have additional opportunities to work on it, I'll withdraw my motion to amend at this time.
The motion is
75?
Mm-hmm. Right. What do you think of your president from the last motion? What's called that? Thank you,
Barry. Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Church?
Aye.
Babbitt?
Aye.
Mary Carey?
Right. And only one other thing I'm doing, but it relates again to what Senator Cook said, that has to do with the $15,000 exemption on real property. That if we're going to land that each person gets an exemption, then I'm not willing to go for a $30,000 exemption on real property. So how we land on that determines where I land on the value.
You know, one of the things that I...
Either one, yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying, and I'm...
Madam Chairman, in line with that, I'm a real believer in clarifying the law when we have a shot at it, and I think we ought to clarify our policy in this bill while we have it here and make it clear that it's either available to one or both on each of these things. And maybe we ought to think about under what circumstances. Certainly if both husband and wife, I think if both husband and wife are employed and require their motor vehicle as transportation to get to and from, then they probably each are entitled. Yeah, but I think that a married person usually needs a larger home than a single person. And they also are entitled to own separately property. I personally would think that double is pretty fair for husband and wife. Maybe it should be 75 and 70. Maybe if we clarify it, that may eliminate. Now, what's your view on that? Could we ask him, please?
Mr. Forrester, would you like to respond?
I've researched this point and also asked the same person the question of what the current practice is. I'm doubling up, and the standard is, number one, no doubling up is occurred on Homestead exemption. Although the trend would be, at least anticipated trend, that at some point, because of the Equal Rights Amendment and so forth, that Dublin might be anticipated, and the test would be very much like the test Senator Cook suggested, that who's working and who's contributing. And if the question would be up for resolution as to whether working at home is working within that test.
Well, I don't want to get into that.
You're the one to vote against that.
I got a vote yes on that. So if you're going to look at Homestead exemption as a separate one for each home instead of the way it has been up to now, more or less as a preventive of the family, then allowing each person in the house to double to claim some exemption may solve the problem, although there is a troublesome area if one person decides to waive it and there's a rest of the family deal with. So doubling up exemption in that case, if you allow each person to plan, may solve the problem. If you look at it as a family purpose exemption, then a single exemption, one exemption for one household would be preferable, and that's a policy decision which, you're much more qualified to make than anybody else.
There have been, to your knowledge, no cases gone to the Supreme Court on this question in Oregon, have there?
No, they haven't. There's a number of cases in which both parties are bankrupt and both parties claim exemption, but it's always $7,500 or $5,000 previously. And either somebody is committing all taxes or by omitting to claim both, or the historical interpretation is that it's a family purpose exemption. Uh-huh. And there's nothing directly which says what it is. It just deals with the problem as...
Has the bankruptcy court, has the federal court interpreted the Oregon law as it relates to bankruptcy?
I've talked to Judge Sullivan, and again, he says that he's not aware of this district doubling up this particular exemption, because this deals with the owner rather than the head of the household. And he's not aware of any doubling up here. Although he said that given the fact situation where both parties were working, contributing, and it was a bona fide contribution on both sides, that he would consider it.
Boy, how did he get the contribution out of owner? That's interesting.
Well, the amazing thing is no one has ever tested it.
Mm-hmm.
No. Bob came to Don and saying that even though the statute says owner, that if it's his contribution, he will consider it. They must assume tenancy by entirety. He's adding, in fact, the requiring contribution, which is contrary to Oregon law.
Because otherwise, you look at it as a gift with a tendency to be cost credited, which is the rational reason, which is why he looks at who actually. That's the standard that he was using.
Well, I understand, yeah. But I don't think he's on any firmer ground.
Oh, yeah.
To wander off into that path as he is.
Sure, I think, right.
How would this, if we adopt the separate but equal doctrine here, how would this affect the other claims, the other recommended changes that you're suggesting here? Do you think that would be sufficient in each of these others?
In terms of flooding, I think even if you adopt separate and equal, the amounts are so small that I think the proposed amendment to be carried out. In terms of tools of trade, maybe that's fighting too high. In terms of the vehicle, $400 even $400 and there's only one person. I don't think in this day and age buys a moving car. if that's the purpose, then perhaps it should be. Recently, back to court, Judge Sullivan was referring.
Except for mine.
Judge Sullivan was referring to 90-year-old Volkswagen with the same engine that says that 450, and therefore was sold with $50 to be paid. So that $400, even for a single person, would not do it, and perhaps if you're going to double that, then 800 is too high, but I think you could raise above 400. As good amounts that, perhaps you could raise 200 up to 600, and seems to me that if both parties claim the use of the car, then if you double that to 1200, it's still a reasonable thing. The problems of these amounts are really not kind of problems of bankruptcy, at least of these initial amounts, because by the time you get to bankruptcy, the bankruptcy court, most of the creditors have already taken what's coming to them in terms of security interest and so forth. So by the time you get to bankruptcy court, these amounts are not as important as in a regular execution.
Yeah, and about the only thing you usually end up in bankruptcy with is a car and a house, and the rest of them, rarely have the others been involved. Tools, occasionally.
This is a car and a house. The other problem that was mentioned, to discussing policy, and a number of people said that was a serious problem, I just bring it up for what it's worth, is that the mobile home exemption was felt to be prejudicial and unfair, and that it was distinguished from homestead exemption. It was felt that it was special prejudice on people living in eastern and southern Oregon, where the major new housing acquisitions are mobile homes. And The price of a mobile home between $12,000 and $15,000 plus the price of the land and installation makes it more or less the same cost as a regular home. And at least Jeff Sullivan felt that that he would be willing, with the case came up in front of him, to make the equal protection argument and that distinction.
How about the difference though between land and the improvement? Shouldn't these, have you discussed with Judge Sullivan whether or not he would be willing to recognize the distinction between the land and the improvement? If let's say that a mobile home owner, and this is a rare case, I think, a mobile home owner who had it on his own plot of land, I don't know how we deal with that now.
Well, it's part of one of the acts amendments for mobile home attempts.
Would it allow, it would seem reasonable to me that we should allow a combined land and improvement exemption of $7,500 for a mobile home owner. All right, that seems rational. How then should we deal with the mobile home owner who, as is more typical, at least in the Portland metropolitan area, who has the mobile home located on leased premises? Should we say maybe two-thirds? Maybe we should allow five and five or something? What would you say?
Okay. Well, let me say the present statute doesn't deal with that. The present exemption deals with a mobile home and property upon which the mobile home is situated that is the actual abode and occupied by the owner. It doesn't make distinction between property and mobile home. It's not occupied by the owner, so maybe that distinction should come in. But it only deals, as far as I can see.
Well, what I'd like to request.
Anyone want to make an opinion, suggest an opinion today on whether homestead should be for a family purpose or an individual?
Madam Chairman?
Yes?
Before we get to that, first of all, I would like to have Mr. DeWinter prepare some amendments so as to make the mobile home correspond to other homes so that could have a combined exemption for mobile home and land equal to a fixed home and land, and in addition to allow the mobile home owner on leased premises to claim two-thirds of the exemption that he can claim on the combined on the improvement. That's the first thing that I think would make them equivalent. And I won't move that at the moment, but I would like to have a think about it. But I would like to move, then, in line with your suggestion, I move that it shall be the policy of this committee and this act that each individual is treated as a separate, viable individual with separate rights, irrespective of whether he or she works out of the home or is only a homemaker, so that our exemption rights are individual rights to the man and woman, which may be joined and united, but are separate rights.
Motion is in section 4 on page 5 of Penal 229 that each spouse shall have an individual right to the amount which is set forth in the statute, whatever it might be. Discussion? Let's call the roll.
Debbie Barrett?
Aye.
Harrison?
At the moment, no.
Good.
Aye.
Rabbit? Aye.
Just to suppose my that the wife would be on the deed in some way joint.
Yeah, I think it presupposes that the wife has a
property.
Madam
Chairman, just in passing, I think we better go back and check the, now that we've adopted the separatism on section 4, we better go back and clean up some of the other. Well, we got vehicles, we got mobile homes, we got the other things. I think I'm just arguing we got to clear it, and I don't think there's necessarily one policy we have to adopt, it, but they have to establish to adopt. But now we've done it for homestead, it raises questions on all the others.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I would think I agree with Senator Carson. I think it should be the same policy throughout, recognizing, however, that there may be differences. I'm not sure that we should necessarily extend the needed automobile to a person whether he or she is employed. You know, in other words, that's the next question. Does the homemaker require a separate automobile?
If they have teenage children, I would say absolutely. I take the bus, as a matter of fact. It's easy, and I'm the working one.
Unquote.
Well,
I think Mr. Forrester, if he's more the committee, is fine. I think it'd be best to let him work with this and discuss it with committee members because he's going to get bogged down in this. Let's turn the page to 135. Is there anybody here from the Uniform Commission? We have a date that has filled in on there.
Was there, was no objection to, is this the one that we asked the revenue, or the revenue department representative, the inheritance tax representative, whether this would have any effect or not, or is that one of the other bills?
Excuse me, Madam Chairman, that was 139 that had to do with allocation of principal and income on trust.
Well, I'm thinking about it. The revenue representative who was here then and said he didn't see any revenue consequences saw me as I was walking across the campus my office to say that now he thinks maybe there are some. So I think before we act on that, we ought to ask Ken Linegar, I think was his name, to come back. That's 139.
I'm coming on our way through, but I just meant to bring you up today to 142. It's not on the agenda. That's our smallest pay tax. I've talked with several people about it, particularly Bob Smith from Union Title. He's going to do some study on raising it to 10,000, and the committee would call that how we got it back. We can't then. There's two other areas I'd like to have John get a hold of Mr. Pendergast and talk about. Three other areas. One is the qualifications for the claimant successor. The question's been raised, can a team to be a, who might be the claimant successor to file the affidavit? And I think the answer should be no, personally. I think it's an adult. Or the part-time, yeah. Which would be very complicated. But the claiming successor, we saw the problem to be one or more, but technically a claiming successor means the heir or heir, and the heir might be a 3-year-old child, and you've got that problem. Two, there needs to be something that closed the door for title companies. This is what they're worried about, some order. Some final affidavit is one suggestion, maybe a closing affidavit by the claimant successor saying nothing has changed during the 4 months of the administration of the particular estate. And finally, there is a conflict between the will contest and the Small Estate Act. Apparently, and I haven't reached this, but the time for a will count, the contest starts to run when it's offered under the regular solemn form of probate. We never offer it, so technically that's a whole of the Small Estate Act, or it could be argued. I think when it's admitted in solemn form, and I think the problem is, for instance, I've had a small estate with a will, and
isn't it admitted in solemn form when it's offered with the affidavit?
Well, I think witness? That's the issue. And maybe it's John to just check and see what he saw. But other than that, I think we should go. I don't think, and you might ask Mr. Pendergast if there's any criticism that going. I think if I understand the committee correctly, we were willing to go to, or at least I was, suggested and didn't hear anything. Great. Sure. Going to 10,000, leaving at 10,000. But it could be all personally. Now it's 5,000 personally, and you can go off to 10 if you have real property. Leaving it at 10 no matter what the mix is. And there was some concerns with how companies if you go much beyond that, because it really is a quick way of doing it, and they're a little flighty on going much above 10.
Have we had any concern by anyone about abuse by personal representatives under broader?
Not that I've heard. It's relatively new, I think, and then a lot of people know about it, actually. Thank you.
The next one is here, too, Senator 36.
Oh, I took my bill. I'm sorry. By yours, I think you mean that I'm...
You were going to check out.
Yeah. I'm not that strong, Chairman. I apologize. Dr. Sullivan is in communication with me, and I have not got back to it. The issue, if I recall, was recommitment, and or whether when they put the maximum time I vote no, frankly. Dr. Sullivan raised the issue that, if you recall, the question was, we're spending the maximum time when it had to be released to be no longer than the original assembly.
So you got to pick up four
things. Well, the first major change is in section one, where if the bill is passed, where a person is determined not guilty by reason of insanity, however, he's not placed in custody, he's placed under someone's supervision. Currently, the person under the supervision the NGI has placed has to accept that supervision, if it's the Oregon State Hospital or whatever. Section 1 would change that and say that the person to whom the judge has given the NGI can say, I don't want to accept supervision, and the individual can say, I don't want to be treated by the mental health division. If either of those things occur, then the person would have to come back before the judge, I take it, and the judge would have to find some other way of handling the person determined NGI. The other major change is in section 2, where currently, where a person is found not guilty by reason of insanity, and the judge believes he should be placed in custody, there's a 90-day minimum waiting period before the health division can come back and suggest that the person is no longer in need of their treatment. Section 2 would delete that 90-day requirement. The thing that I think you're talking about, Senator Carson, is the change that relates to when somebody is found unfit to proceed and they're sent to the health division. The change that this bill would make would say that a person would stay with the health division for a maximum of whatever the maximum sentence is of the charge that the complaint contains, or 5 years, whichever is less. And then a person who was determined unfit to proceed would be released without any further supervision. The other major change that I see is that giving credit for time that a person spends in any state institution prior to the act. If they're eventually found guilty of the crime charge, so they get any time that they've spent in a state institution or under any type of supervision imposed by the court while they're unfit to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I think that items 2 and 3 I have some difficulty with. 1 and 4 I my personal have no problem with, but I think it still is possible for a person to be found unfit to trial. Murder should carry a life sentence maximum. After 5 years, he could be found fit, and the 5 years comes up, he's still unfit to go to trial, and he'd be released. The answer is he could then be recommitted as an incompetent person. I think that's too great a risk for society to work that risk. I believe that's a whole of the premise, but I'm not willing to require the district attorney to wait at the door to recommit to somebody else. And I'm not, so I've been letting somebody out 5 years when he's unfit. He's fit to get out of the hospital, he's fit to go to trial. He's not fit to get out of the hospital.
Now, what you're saying is that does our present law give some automatic credits for time spent?
No, I'm not having a problem. Yeah, that's fine. I think that's a good idea. Presently, I think the problem has come up, and it's a concern that I'm not there in a judgment. That some people, that I guess, are out there that have been found unfit to stand trial. And they put them out there, and they might, of course, been innocent of the charge that they originally went out there for. But they're unfit, and they just, until they're fit, they spend the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. Well, to begin at by for having a crime that prior to the determination of either to it or after the determination of either to it, that the court will then immediately determine how that person is able to stand trial. If the person is not an assistant to recommit to a hospital or at work,
yeah, the person then will get the back of the card if he wants to go to the institute, but that's not what the bill is.
They get credit for being there under mental restraint.
That would be the if, for instance, they're put out there because they're unfit to stand trial, then they're fit. They go in and sit there out there 8 years, and they're found fit. They go to trial and they're convicted, and they get a 10-year sentence. They only have 2 more years to serve nationally because of their commitment to state mental institution qualifies as time, as I understand it. Qualifies as time towards the eventual criminal sentence.
If this bill is
passed.
That really doesn't seem sensible to me in this respect. The fact that a person was detained for mental reasons, I don't like to have that thought of as a part of the penalty. I think it's reasonable it should be considered when it comes to parole and probation. And I don't know what our practice on parole and probation is, legally and practically. In other words, it would seem to me that that's something that a probationary authority should be able to bear in mind. But I don't like the confusion of mental detention with a penalty, so that in effect it's part of the penalty. We're penalizing them. Or with the reverse penalty, we're saying it was part of the penalty after the fact, therefore we give them credit for it. I don't know if that's a good policy. It doesn't strike me as being super good. On the other hand, maybe we have certain arbitrary probation and parole practices, and maybe we ought to approach that. And maybe we ought to say in probation and parole that the parole and probation officers must recognize this and take it into account and consider it, give it consideration in part, as though it may have been time since. I'm just barely learning a little bit this year about parole and probation practices. There is a certain arbitrariness about it. I don't know what part of that arbitrariness is required by statute and what part of it is the policy of the Board of Parole and Probation. Can you tell me that? Do you know? Very little in the law. Now, I'd like to think of it in that way, in a, to a degree. Well, maybe we should legislate on it. I don't really like to think of it as being accredited, because if this person, now it doesn't seem likely, if it's considered necessary that he receive a sentence of 10 years, either because of trying to deter someone, which is, you know, most of us don't want to be the ghost of that, but occasionally it happens, or that he be deterred, or that society be protected. I don't know what might happen if the sentence is large enough. Is the judge just going to increase it by enough so that he catches him one way or another? I'm not sure whether the judge ought to necessarily be thinking about that deterrent period or that reform period when he imposes the sentence.
Do you want to make any motion on 7476?
Well, theoretically, we could, if we can justify our position, there are enough votes to pass it.
I want to make one thing. Mr. Governor is working very hard a day. And you can't send him off on any research project. You said all he can do is keep up his bills.
How about the bar, which sponsors this bill?
Right. If they want to do it.
Well, it seems to me this. First of all, I think it sounds like it's reasonable to me. And I think what we ought to do, we ought to ask, what's his name, Culp, and Reed, the people out at the pen, to come in and talk to us and with us about what they're doing now, and hear and tell us. Apparently they've contacted Norm Howard, at least, objecting. I don't know that they've been before this committee. I don't think they have they? Tell us why they object to Senate Bill 44, number one. And then we ought to examine, again, I think we should consult with the bar and see if there's someone who's assigned to this to be there here at that time and who may have been privy.
Mr. Stowell appeared on it before. Was anyone here, Mr. Stowell, then? Do you want to hear White
Cross? I'd like to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, Mr. Stowell, in his letter, indicated that so far as he knew, the bill was unopposed by any congressional other group. And I think that should be ironed out because Senator Howard indicated the contrary. Mm-hmm. And I think the Senate was not really made aware of the judicial authority for the proposition of having these rules.
Well, maybe we should have that if we don't have it. Do we have that?
In the Stowell letter, there are cases cited, which indicate it's part of the due process.
I'm Chairman, would the committee consider at all a committee bill that would provide this right to all of us by amending Chapter 183 and saying all bureaucratic language has to be reduced so that man's common ordinary understanding can reach out on stuff? I think it's less troublesome in the corrections than it is in revenue and a variety of others. And I don't think, I think we're touching just the wrong area of it. I think it's implicit that it doesn't have to be. If we pass this statute, we can put it to the president to be this way and all the other rules. And I think that that's
the case.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, so
having confessed guilt, I'll say I hope you approve, yeah.
Thornton got elected Attorney General with a promise to write a ballot slogan that could be clearly understood. And
that was
in 1952. And I don't know that things have been a whole lot better since then. So I just don't think it's possible to have this. But this is a little separate. This involves detention and some cases specifically on point, whereas I gather the other bill deals with civil.
It involves discipline, really. And detention only in the sense of a different place and more severe detention. But I'm reasonably confident that regulations of the CDC, the given subcompany, the regulations of the Department of Agriculture, and certain farmers, of all the implications of discipline that this has, and their language is not much more understandable in many cases than.
No. Yes.
Yeah.
We're dealing with a different, I think, kind of person here. If we take the whole group as a kind of different sort of individual and the person who is not in the penitentiary, and that is, you only have to talk to them to understand it. In this case, it's a February agenda.
Legal skills that extend beyond lawyers, I know. So, and I have a
punished. And that's all I can say. Those that will be taking advantage of this will not be those that don't understand, but be those that really do understand. And we'll miss the mark on the celibate. Won't even know what we've done.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to suggest, in addition to the authorities at the prison and the correctional institution, I think, whoever that is, I don't know who that would be, that we should invite, contact Stevie Remington of the ACLU, because they sent out a letter on this. Yeah, and have her and whoever they want to come here at that time, as well as Mr. Stoll, if he can tell us some other member of the bar who is concerned with this, if there is another, and invite them to be here at the same time.
Well, must have from the committee.
Must have, yeah. I don't know how expert young Robert Stoll is on these things.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's as much as we can do.